Hi everyone, it's Chris Deasy here. Welcome to the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews, and it was such a pleasure this week to catch up with Professor David Cheetham. Now, David is Professor of Philosophy and Theology at Birmingham. He's been there since 1999, and we talk about the second nature element of Zoom and how it's affected our teaching, and we learn why David is an optimist about life post-lockdown. We were both students at Lampeter. And David talks in the interview about how Lampeter influenced him, though there was perhaps more going on than simply his academic achievements. We discuss David's memories of living in Lampeter at a time when you had to make your own entertainment in a way that you wouldn't have done in a city in the same way, and why Lampeter was like a self-contained ecosystem, and why he didn't have to worry about tomorrow. He talks about Edmund Estefan and the Madroilian sound machine, where he was the keyboardist, and he had originally wanted to be a musician, and perhaps ironically Lampeter enabled him, through going there to do a degree in theology, to become a musician. He remembers running over to the local Chinese takeaway for 11 o'clock. Now, David is not the first person I've interviewed who has written a PhD on John Hick, and David talks about meeting John Hick over a strong sherry, and there's a hilarious story about how David had a clash between the blend band rehearsal and seeing John Hick give a public talk. We learn why Hick was worried about his seminal Death and Eternal Life would be perceived, and we talk about Paul Badham's influence on both of us and Paul's defence of dualism. We learn what David's younger self would have expected him to do, and how his school teacher, when David was about 14 or 15, thought that he was a bit too ambitious when he said that he wanted to be a professor. And I ask whether our tutors at university could ever have known what we got up to outside of our academic work. And at the very end of the interview, we find out why David has a good nostalgia about what he has done in his life. It was such a thrill to catch up for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews with David Cheetham. My name is Chris Deasy. Okay, well, it is a great pleasure to have David Cheetham for my latest nostalgia interview. And David, because we came really close to recording one face-to-face a couple of years ago, but Zoom, as we were just saying before we started recording, Zoom has afforded us this incredible opportunity to do all the sort of things that we'll look back in the future and just think, what was the problem? You know, just travel from one place to another. Why would you do that? You just go onto Zoom to meet your colleagues and friends.
I remember definitely, I mean, I remember talking to colleagues because there was about a year ago or 2 years ago now, I was the head of school and I had to tell everyone, oh, well, look, we're about to go into a really novel situation. And I've discovered this really good thing called Zoom, which we're all going to use. And of course, we regarded it as a kind of exception, didn't we? That I think you had to get special permission actually at the university to use Zoom because it was, you know, default that you'd be face to face, if you know what I mean. But now it's absolutely second nature. And it seems that, you know, us talking like this is quite normal, isn't it, really? It's not an exceptional thing at all.
No, and it's funny because I remember having a conversation actually with you about, you know, doing interviews via Skype. And I thought, yeah, but it's actually nice to meet somebody and have a coffee with them. And it's more time consuming. But I also thought, you know, it's like I've never been an anthropologist or an ethnographer. But, you know, the thought of actually spending time in somebody's environment or them coming to me, you know, kind of makes it a bit more special and memorable. Like holiday, I suppose it's the equivalent of going on holiday with a postcard when you've got the postcard as a way of remembering, you know, that you've been to this place and, you know, the interview when you can actually say, yes, I spent that afternoon in Birmingham or Scarborough or wherever it may have been. But you are right. And now, of course, I've been able to do interviews with people in New Zealand and Canada and the US that, you know, that simply wouldn't have really been on my radar. But how have you found the last 18 months since we went into online teaching?
It's funny, isn't it? Because, I mean, sometimes, I mean, like you, Chris, I mean, I've had to prepare lectures for students and have to do it like this, talking to a camera, basically trying to be as interesting as I possibly can. And I looked at some of my old lectures as I used to teach in face-to-face. And those lectures tend to last about, say, an hour and a half or so, because you're half expecting to be interrupted by people, aren't you, in the room when you're talking. So, you know, you'll go off on a digression or something. But then when you tape yourself, it's amazing how much time you cut away and how much what you think was going to last a really long time actually lasts quite a short time. So you end up with about half an hour's worth of stuff that normally takes about an hour and 10 minutes. So it's cut away a lot of the extras, if you know what I mean. You know, you said that, you know, sometimes it's nice to go and visit somebody in person. And of course, you know, you spend time getting a coffee, sitting down, finding a good location, and then you have a conversation with somebody or you talk to them. But Zoom is very clipped. So, you know, I'm looking at my diary now, because I'm talking to you now, but in about half an hour's, well, a bit longer than that, about an hour's time, I've got to see somebody, then I've got to see somebody after that. And so you've crammed everyone in. Yeah. And so I find, I don't know about you, that it's quite exhausting, isn't it? Because you're imagining that the time is very much more efficient than it used to be, because you used to allow for time to walk between meetings, you know, going to a cafe, having a break, taking time just to look around. But we've tended to think about our lives very much as being in these compartments of one Zoom after another. And of course, then you leave your room and you go next door into the lounge. And of course, BBC are interviewing somebody on Zoom. Yeah. So your whole world is just this, I've got a box, you've got a box over there, there's two other people in the room and so on. It's a strange sort of world that, you know, it's become our reality, hasn't it, really?
Yeah, and even things, I mean, obviously like reunions are not, certainly our Lampeter reunion, we'll obviously come on to our Lampeter connection in a minute, but certainly I found that although I have returned to going to the cinema, I did a few months ago think, you know, am I going to just get caught up now in a world of streaming? Because, you know, I'd avoided it up to that point because I sort of liked the rituals, I liked the events. If I've been in work all day, you know, sometimes seeing a film in the evening is something to look forward to, was watching on your sofa at home kind of feels a bit more anticlimactic. But somehow during lockdown, we all had to press that reset button. And it is interesting, not least in terms of teaching, as to whether we will ever return to doing things the way we did. But in a good way, that, you know, that we're actually entertaining those sort of...
I agree with, I mean, I know that like you, I was, whenever, you know, throughout the entire year, there's been a kind of like an easing of lockdown and then a tightening it up again. And whenever there was an easing of it, I was always the first to go to a restaurant or the first to kind of take that opportunity to have a pint in the pub when it first opened. Mm-hmm. Because I really do feel for some of these places that are kind of, I mean, we're okay. We're university people. We can do this sort of thing like this. But there are people who depend upon, their whole livelihood is about being with people, about either entertaining us through the theatre or whatever, or serving us in a restaurant. And that's what their livelihoods are. So, you know, I mean, I'm keen to take advantage of liberation when it comes, because I think it would be a great loss to, I mean, I think, was it Cineworld? Didn't they end up sort of closing half their cinemas? And some of them now have reopened. But it's a worrying thing, isn't it, that people might move to just watching Netflix at home, and that just becomes the only experience you're allowed in those sorts of things. I hope people will remember that that's not really how, you know, we want to live our lives anymore. But there we are.
No, I think you're right, because what I was finding in the autumn is that I was posting pictures from cinemas, as I always sort of tend to do on Facebook. But obviously, I'm going to try and make sure that I don't get anybody else in the shot anyway, because I don't, you know, people may not want to sort of be identified. But also, the cinemas were fairly empty anyway. So what was happening is a case of, oh, Chris is at the cinema again tonight, and he's the only one there. And of course, that was fueling this sort of myth that I was the only person, probably in the whole country, going to the cinema. So when Cineworld closed, and I think it was because of the Bond film that they decided not to release in the autumn, and I think they just looked at it and just thought, well, if the Bond film's not going to run, we're just going to have to keep repeating the same films over and over. Because I was like seeing the same film, you know, two or even in some cases three times at the cinema, like Tenet, although it took about four times to actually understand what it was all about. So that was actually to my benefit. But yeah, you're right. And I think that even people who worked in the cinema chains probably, you know, the back of their mind may have wondered whether they'd actually be returning to their jobs once lockdown was eased.
Well, let's hope it does happen, because I think, and I don't know about you, I'm an optimist. I mean, people can say, oh, things are going to go this way, but I always tend to think that things are never as bad as you think sometimes. And I'm hoping that when everyone gets back, there'll be kind of like a rebound effect. And you might find a real, I mean, the Bond film might be good to get everyone back to the cinema again. There might be people cramming into the cinema just for that occasion. I think actually it'll be really emotional, won't it? You think about it. I mean, there are lots of occasions where people get together. And when they do get together again, when they remember what happened 18 months ago, when they took that as being just normal life, it'll be quite emotional, I think, for people to suddenly realise they're doing things that they used to do, and then they'll maybe remember just how much they miss them.
Yeah, and well, indeed, and that's a perfect seg to obviously what we're going to be talking about in relation to nostalgia, because obviously you're in Birmingham, and actually maybe it's worth just saying a little bit about actually what you do at Birmingham and how long you've been there.
Oh, right. Well, okay. I've been at Birmingham now for about 20 years. So I'm now, the last couple of years, I'm a professor at the University of Birmingham in philosophy and theology. Nothing useful. I'm currently looking out of a new window. So I've just moved into my new office. Just been a bit of a change of offices. So I'm looking forward to the new term. But yeah, I've been here for about 20 years. I came here, actually more than that. I came in 1999, so it's about 22 years now, isn't it, really? Yeah. Been at Birmingham for 20 years. Before then, I went to a number of different kind of colleges as a part-time lecturer, trying to find my first post, if you know what I mean, all the way back to Lambeter. So I think I managed to get my first job at a university about a couple of years. Oh, yeah, well, just about after I finished my PhD at Lambeter back in 1994. I was at Glasgow, being a research fellow there, you see, for a couple of years. And then I got a couple of sort of part-time jobs around Worcester and Newman College. But then I managed to bag this job at Birmingham. So I've been here ever since. And really enjoyed it. I love the place, actually.
Yeah, and it's funny with generations, because you mentioned 22 years, and it's 22 years since I got my PhD. But, you know, the students I'm teaching now weren't born. I've been at Kent for 17 years. And so it means that the students that I'm teaching now would have been in nursery. Give it a couple of years, they wouldn't have been born. You know, indeed, if it's 17 years, give it one more year. When I came here, they wouldn't even have been born. And I think that also creates a lot of reflection, because obviously we know each other through our Lambeter links, and indeed you were doing your PhD in the same department that I was an undergraduate, and then obviously I became a postgraduate.
Did we have the same supervisor, Chris? I
had Chris Arthur as my supervisor, but Paul Badham, well, he was certainly my internal examiner on the PhD, but no, Paul was both an undergraduate, and when I did the MA in Death and Immortality, he was obviously foundational to that. So in many ways, Paul is certainly the honorary supervisor, because he was certainly integral, indeed, to all of my teaching now. Because whenever I'm teaching on death and the afterlife, in a way, there's a lot of film in there that Paul certainly was never involved with. But the edifice of that module, and indeed John Hick appears a lot, which obviously I'm sure we'll come on to in a moment. But that was absolutely, you know, integral to my academic career.
Well, I think it sounds like we did very much the same. I think I did the Death and Immortality MA as well, you see. So, and that was, I think I did it before you. So that MA had only just started. But I remember Paul being very kind of illuminating, actually, because that really was his expertise, if I remember. So, and I think I'm just like you, I've borrowed some of the things that I remember he taught me, and I've used those same sort of things on my students. It's often enough, that's the kind of topic I find that students are most interested in sometimes. So they find that a really compelling area. And they tend to write all the essay questions that I set. The one on death and immortality tends to get the most responses, if you know what I mean.
Yeah, and I mean, near-death experiences, that's huge, obviously. Yeah, that's, and they all do that. Although I learned a lesson a few years ago, because we were running a module. It was called Issues in Religious Studies, and we would all do 2 weeks. It doesn't run anymore. It was a great sort of methodologically-based course, but I did implicit religion and then near-death experiences. And then we were told then that we would just mark the questions that the students wrote on. So the idea was that we all did two lectures each, and therefore we'd share the marking load. Then all the essays came in. It was like, 83% of the students wrote on near-death experiences. So it's like, oh, Chris, you got your marking cut out. But you are right, and mind-dependent worlds as well. And whenever I'm teaching it, I kind of feel, I don't know how you feel, because obviously we work in the same profession, but I always find that I'm kind of, not just in terms of the content, but in terms of even the style of delivery, I'm channeling Paul Badham and all those Lambeter greats. You know, it's their enthusiasm from up to 30 years ago that both inspired me to continue in the profession. And I kind of feel I'm somehow embodying them.
It is interesting, isn't it? Because I know you're going to come onto this topic in a minute. Maybe we're actually straying into that now. I don't know. But I mean, I look back and I think, well, how much did Al Lambeter influence me in terms of the actual subject I studied? Now, I have to be honest and say that when I was at Lambeter, I had lots of other things I was interested in, if I could put it that way, beyond just my studies in theology. So I asked myself, how much of an influence did this department have on me in terms of my intellectual development? And I think that you're right. I mean, there are certain people like Paul and others who still stick in the mind, and you still remember some of the things that they said in lectures, key sentences that struck you. And so I can still remember some of those, despite the fact that I think towards the end of my time at Lambeth, I was going to lectures rather less often than I should have done. they were an influential bunch, weren't they, really?
Yeah, and also I think because it was obviously a very small place, but also a department that pulled above its weight, and I think that it's even now this is a good example. So on social media, which obviously we didn't have all those decades ago, whenever I post anything about maybe a lecture I'm doing on near-death experiences, suddenly there'll be people from 20, 30 years ago that I didn't even know were necessarily Facebook friends, who I'd forgotten because that I don't sort of have much contact with them, who would suddenly like, oh, thank you for posting this because it brings me back to that day in 1992 or whatever it might have been when they had this sort of life-changing sort of experience, or that they studied something that actually to this day they still want to follow through. And actually I'll be interviewing a couple of former Lampeter associated NDE researchers actually in the coming including some of Paul's own research students. So Lampeter's legacy has been phenomenal. When did the journey start for you? Was it sort of 88, is that right?
Actually it was 87, believe it for me. It was autumn 87. Would I go up to Lambeter or go across to Lambeter? I can't remember now. It took 4 hours to get to Lambeter, whether I was getting up or down to Lambeter.
Well, where were you before that? Where were you travelling?
I was High Wycombe area. So I was in the south. I went to John Hampden School. It used to take about 4 hours in the car to get to Lambeter from High Wycombe. Yeah. And you could either just decide to go down the M4 or weave or cross much of England by the A40 or something, if I remember. I started in 87, yeah. Doing a degree in theology, basically. So and at that time, I think Lambeter had averaged about 800 students, I think, in total. So it was just on an upward climb. As it reached a point when in the kind of early 90s where it was really getting to its kind of zenith, I think, in terms of student numbers. I think it hit about 2,000 or 3,000 or something at some point. Yeah. But when I went there, it was about 800 people, and it was on an upward climb of getting more students. Yeah. 87 was when it started.
Yeah, and there's something magical. Well, obviously, there's the Magic Mountain as well, but there's something about the place which almost feels very strange, because I did stay there, obviously, as you did, many years after our first degrees, and obviously we did postgraduate studies there. But in my case, I feel that by 2001, which is when I left, I had a loyalty and a vestigial loyalty to the place, but I think I probably was ready to leave back then because, my cinema interest and, things which I didn't have a decade earlier were sending me, more towards, urban sort of conurbations.
Well, that's it. When I started in 87, I think the nearest traffic light was 11 miles away. So it was quite a... they had film clubs. It was really quite 1980s, let's put it this way. So, and they would show a film that had been out maybe a year before or something on what you might call an urban cinema. So, I take it with your interest in particular that, you'd have to go to Cardiff or Swansea, I take it, to go and see a decent recent movie that came out. But that was what was so wonderful about it. I mean, now, we have Zoom, we have mobile phones, we have computers, we have the internet. But then in Lambeter, you had to make your own entertainment. You had to be the students that I met. And I still meet some of these guys, obviously, years and, 30 odd years later, they become lifelong friends. But we really had to make our own entertainment, and so much more so in Lambeter than any other place. I mean, had I been in Birmingham, say, as an undergraduate, of course, I would have had a whole city to entertain me, if you know what I mean. But at Lambeter, there were some famous pubs in Lambeter, obviously, we all frequented. There was the arts hall, there was the student bar, and that was about it, really. And entertainment was whatever we managed to get in terms of which bands were willing to travel 4 hours, as it were, to get to Lambeter. So, we had a few headliners, as it were, but we had to make our own entertainment. And I always remember that as being one of the wonderful things about Lambeter is that we all had to just do something. And it was fantastic. I mean, I know some people have mixed memories, but when I look back, I just have a very warm memory of Lambeter. It's 30 years ago now, Chris, you see, and I can't remember so many. I can remember some details quite vividly. But interestingly, all the things that, you know, were negative about Lambeter, I've sort of faded into the background. So whenever I go back and visit, I do get a wonderful sense of calm for some reason. I was talking to Edmund Simons. You may be interviewing him at some point, of the Blend Man. But I said to, Edmund, I said to him that, you know, I sleep really well when I visit Lambeter. And I think Lambeter was that peculiar place whereby there was no tomorrow. I don't know if you felt that way, because the Lambeter was in this kind of this self-contained ecosystem of people. We all know each other. We all can recognize what it meant to us all. But I don't think, I mean, I know students in my in Birmingham who worry terribly about employability. But to be honest, at Lambeter, you didn't worry about that. You were in this, you know, wonderful liberal arts college with some fantastically original people. And if you look, if you meet some of these people now again, you realise that they've done some amazing things and they've all distinguished themselves in various ways. But I think it's something part of what the place is all about that generated that, the fact that we had to do something to make something for ourselves at the, at that place. But I mean, because I was just interested in the, that day's events, who I was going to meet later on, an event I was going to go to later on that evening, I never worried about what the next week would bring or the week after that. And so maybe that's the clue to why when I go to Lambeter, I sleep really well because I don't worry about the next day because the next day just is what it's going to be. And I love that about Lambeter. I realise after all these years, it's the one of those places I can go to and genuinely feel at home and not worried about the next day.
Yeah, and I think also because when I went there, many of my school friends hadn't heard of the place. And they were all going eastwards, or actually in many cases staying in Cardiff. But I went westwards, and it was the best thing I could have done, because what it meant is that, you know, for good and sometimes ill, admittedly, but you'd see the same people every day. And it meant that it fostered friendships, and in some cases, lifelong friendships, which maybe if you're in even at Kent or in Birmingham, it wouldn't happen to the same degree.
Because, yeah.
And what I also found is that it's a very small town, but some very larger than life figures.
Oh yeah.
And maybe if those larger than life figures had gone anywhere else, maybe they were blended in a bit. I don't know. Interesting that your band was called the Blend Band, but it's interesting that in and actually there's something funny on that, because I was just driving up. I only got into my office a few minutes before we started recording, but I've got all these old tapes that I recorded in Lambeter, and I digitized them, so stuff recorded off the radio. And literally just half an hour ago, as I was driving in, on came Gloria Estefan and the Miami Sound Machine. And of course, whenever I hear Gloria Estefan, all I can think of is the tribute. Well, I mean tribute band. Maybe you ought to explain the context here.
That was Edmund Estefan and the Madroillion Sound Machine, I think it was called. That was what can I say about that band? it was I think some of the people in that band, myself not included in that sense, were of a genius level in terms of their brilliance, just sheer satire and self-satire as well. And it was just wonderful being in that whole circuit of people with Justin Rees, Noel Leeman, who ended up becoming, of course, one of the union presidents, and Edmund Simons, of course, wonderful chap, great leader, one of the leaders of that band. And I was the keyboardist, as it were, kind of like sitting at the side of the stage, playing, just watching this insanity unfold as I was going. It was an absolute privilege to be in it. It was such fun, and the wit and the humour that those guys had in producing all those things, like as you say, and some of the songs are actually pretty good. Actually, they stick in the memory, and people who years later talk about Lambeter still remember some of the gigs we used to do, and how well I think we did them in the end, and how well attended they were. I think in 1992, we did a gig where we had a record number of people coming along to it. I mean, we had, you know, big frontline bands turning up to Lambeter, you know, like Doctor and the Medics and that sort of thing. But I think even though they managed to get lots of people going, we managed to pull in a bigger crowd than even they did. And this was a paying ticket kind of attendance. So we were amazed by the kind of loyalty that the Blenheim Band enjoyed. But it was a wonderful, surreal thing to be involved in. And when I joked a minute ago about, you know, how many lectures did I go to at Lambeter? Well, you know, there were much... What formed me at Lambeter was less the lectures, if I'm really honest. I mean, I got into my field much more when I did my PhD than whenever I was going to undergraduate lectures. But it was just the sheer amazingness of meeting all these different kinds of people at Lambeter who were totally original, one of a kind. And it's that formed me more than anything else, which is why I when it came to the end of my degree after 3 years in 1990, I realized that I just couldn't leave. Yeah. I wasn't ready to leave, to be brutally honest. And so I stuck around, you know, for a few more years to do my MA and my PhD. And I think it was when I was doing my PhD, I finally focused on what my studies were actually all about. But so it's kind of like we were talking a minute ago, weren't we, about, you know, how has it been for the last 18 months on Zoom? Well, I can imagine being at Lambeter and having to go on Zoom instead of going to Lambeter itself as in physical form. I mean, Lambeter was all about being together in that kind of strange microcosm. So that's what students, you know, if you think about it, are missing out on. It's that kind of like amazing adventure of what university life is actually all about meeting lots and lots of different, rather crazy people sometimes who totally re-educate you in the way that you look at the world and you see funny things. And you also learn to handle the world differently. I mean, once you've been in the Blenheim Band, to be honest, I mean, everything else is downhill from or else you're prepared for anything, you know, anything that hits you. Won't surprise or shock you. It's a wonderful thing.
Yeah, and also because, of course, sometimes people associate us with our research or the, you know, the publications that we have. And I think maybe when you're starting out in your career, obviously you want to promote the fact that you've had these articles or these books and you know, all the great and important things that we do. Both of us are in our respective offices with bookshelves behind us. And that gives an indication of, you know, what we do professionally. But there is another side, that hinterland. And I think, like you, I certainly did not go to Lambeter ever expecting that I would stay in academia. That wasn't the plan. If anything, my dream was to do something in radio. And you know, I've loved my career in this profession. But Lambeter also enabled me, I think, to foster all those other sort of sides of my personality, which I didn't even know were there. I mean, in your case, you mentioned playing the piano or playing the keyboards, but I don't know if that's something that you were doing before coming or whether suddenly it was like, hey, this is my moment.
That's a really interesting question, actually, because, I mean, before I went to Lambeter, I had lots of interests, and one of them was to be a musician. So I did, you know, my grade 8 in piano and violin and so on. And I think when I was about 15 or 16, I wanted to do music, I think. But then I got interested in theology. You know, I had a kind of a religious conversion when I was about 15. And after that, you know, I felt very much that I should go off and do theology. But oddly enough, when I got to Lambeter, I did music, if you think about it, because I was in not just the Blenheim Band, I was in about 5 other bands. I was in a jazz band. I was in bands that which were not part of the student body, but were a kind of part of the wider circuit around Aberaeron and Carmarthen and places like that. So I ended up doing music more than anything else. And oddly enough, before I went to Lambeter, I was a kind of a classical musician type. But when I got to Lambeter, I met some amazing, of course, you know, rock musicians, people like Justin Rees, who was the lead singer of the Blenheim Band. Now, Justin Rees, he was a brilliant musician, but he was also a fantastic keyboardist. So many of the tricks of the trade I learned about how to play the keyboard in a certain way, I learned from him. And so I can honestly say that, oddly enough, I did do a degree in music. and my tutors were quite original people. So I came out of Lambeter being able to play the keyboard in a very different sort of way. I felt I'd been thoroughly trained as a kind of a pop musician. And a jazz musician as well. So when I emerged from that, I had all these other gifts, rather like yourself, maybe, you kind of find a whole formative element that you've been trained in a whole range of things.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, university can be really leveling because... Yeah. It's easy to look back now, and I think that's also, you know, sort of the nostalgia project, I think, in a way, has come at a perfect time for me, because I... spent so many years away from Lampeter, and maybe on some levels deliberately, because, you know, it was such an important part of my life, but I needed to work out, you know, what direction I was going in. And then, of course, I was then able to properly appreciate just how foundational Lampeter was. So I sort of returned, understanding that, you know, it wasn't just the place I happened to go to university 30 years ago. It was the place that and the people there who, you know, were always playing in my head. You know, random conversations in the quarry or, you know, around the town were, whether the other people are remembering them in the same way is almost, you know, beside the point. The point is that in such a small place, that some of those decisions that I took many years or decades later kind of have their origin in those sort of very intimate conversations in a very small town where you knew and trusted people. And that actually is very leveling, because it, you know, in terms of working out, you know, whenever I return, I don't go back there as an academic. I go back there as somebody who was not just in terms of my academic journey, but my personal growth as well. I owe it to that place.
Yeah, I totally agree with you. And it's funny how it equips you for meeting people as well. You can say that but maybe about lots of places, but at Lampeter, because you had to meet lots of very different people, and because everyone knew within a certain, there was a kind of a mile radius, wasn't there? That was where it all took place, basically. There was the quarry at the fringes, then you had the King's Head at the other fringe or whatever it was, and in between there was this university. Mm. And when you meet people, I don't know, I'm sure this is one thing you recognise also, there is a kind of a kinship that you share with people, isn't there? Because we all have the same memories. And we can all mention, whereas if you're in Birmingham, you can mention some places which other people have never been to. But I think you could name every, you know, eatery or something on the high street. Like everyone remembers the Canton Kitchen or the Chapel of Tandoori. I think I went to the Canton Kitchen, by the way. Strange thing I used to do the first year is that I knew that the Canton Kitchen, the Chinese, would close at about 11 p.m. And so I had a choice whether to stay for the last orders in the bar or run, charge headlong to the Canton Kitchen to get some barbecue spare ribs. And I must have done that as one of my rather more unhealthy habits at Lampeter. I used to run off to the Canton Kitchen just before it closed just to get something before the end of the evening, as it were. So I just remember doing silly things like that in my first year. And of course, when I was there in 1987, I think that was the first year maybe that the Chapler opened. So my claim to fame was I was one of the first guys to have a Merg Tikka Masala in the Chapler Tandoori. Well, maybe I'm not. I mean, you might interview people obviously earlier than me. But I'm sure of our kind of era, if you know what I mean. I think I can claim to be one of the first people to frequent the Chapler.
Yeah, but also I think you hit the nail on the head, because of the smallness of the place, that you could be down the pub at 5 to 11 and you knew that you could make it, or in some cases people would know that they could make their way to the hole in the wall in town. And there's even a debate I remember there was an election for the one of the union officers or the president of the union, and the pitch made by one of them was to have a hole in the wall on campus. But it was then pointed out that great, but at the end of the day, you know, it's like a 5-minute walk maximum to any of the cash machines in town. So, you know, should that be a priority? And in a way that, you know, on the campus where I live, you know, if there wasn't a cash machine, you'd be in some trouble, because you'd literally have to, you know, make a bus journey maybe to get to the hole in the wall. But exactly. In Lampeter, that was part of its charm.
Yeah, I can't think there would be any argument whatsoever for putting things on campus rather than in town, given the fact that they were literally about a 1-minute walk away. I mean, yeah, I could run out of the Union Bar at 10:55 and still guarantee I could get to the Chapel just to place a last order for something. You know, that was only 5 minutes away. That's how small Lampeter was. It was, everything was within easy access in that sense, wasn't it?
Yeah. And what about sort of wider things, which obviously it sounds like were very much cultivated at Lampeter, but you mentioned music. I mean, one of the things which I often talk about in the interviews is the extent to which music played this amazing role in a way that perhaps, funnily enough, didn't then translate into academic study, in the sense that, you know, I went from being obsessed with the charts in the playground at school to then doing a degree in theology. But, you know, I followed a very sort of conventional path. I've done my GCSEs and A-levels, but in so many ways, the things that defined me at the age of 18 would have been very much those sort of childhood conversations in the playground about the various music, the records, as it was in those days, that we bought and what we listened to on the radio. Do you have any of those sort of experiences?
Oh, crumbs. I mean, I remember it was a certain musical world, wasn't it, that we kind of lived in, because I was basically listening to everything in the late 80s, of course, when I was at Mampeter. So I always remember the first the disco that I went to when I was at the first year at Lambeth, where the Communards were playing. What was the name of that famous song?
Oh, Don't Leave Me This Way.
Don't Leave Me This Way. Now, believe it or not, the guy Richard Coles, who of course has become the Reverend Richard Coles, I met him at Birmingham, because he came to give a lecture here once, and I went out for dinner with him. I was given the task of taking the guy out to dinner after he gave the lecture. And I said to him, you know, the first thing I danced to when I was at Lambeter as an 18-year-old was Don't Leave Me This Way by the Communards. And I had this rather freakish conversation with him about, he does this fantastic keyboard solo in the middle of that song, that piano thing, isn't there, that goes on. And I said, you know, I always remember that, being a fantastic solo in the middle of that song. And I said to him, how many takes did you take to do that? And he said, I did it in one take. So I just remember there's a couple of things about that stick in my mind that have somehow come back later on. One of those is meeting Richard Coles from the Communards after being the first song I used to dance to. And I remember that was the first song, because before then, of course, I was this geekish classical music type. You know what I mean? You know the type, Chris. And so I went to Lambeter and I nervously went onto the disco, and that was the song that was playing. So there's a couple of things that stick in my mind about key 80s tracks that always then suddenly take me back to Lambeter.
I had it with the Human League, Don't You Want Me, at one of the Arts Hall Christmas discos, because it was a time when I was much more of a Radio 2 person by that point. And the music was, of course, and all the stuff that Radio 2 plays now, like Trevor Nelson, I'm sure I heard that in Lambeter 30 years ago. But back in, you know, Lambeter 30 years ago, I'd suddenly been at a disco thinking, oh, I don't really know this stuff. There was a Christmas party once, and I thought, it doesn't feel very festive. There's nothing, you know, for me, you know, I thought, not that I was expecting them to play Johnny Mathis, don't get me wrong, but... But suddenly Human League came on, Don't You Want Me, which of course was the Christmas number one in 81. And suddenly I thought, I own this one. So I thought, the fact that I cannot dance is not the point. The point is, I have one opportunity to seize, you know, the moment on this night, to carpe diem this night. And I did for 3-4 minutes. And I think people looked at me and thought, you really like that song, don't you? And it's like, then after that, it was like, oh yeah, that was it. So that I had 3 minutes to...
It was either that or wait for the smoke machine to come on so no one could see you dancing anyway. That was one of my other ploys. But yeah, I mean, it's funny, as people listen, you know, you can watch Top of the Pops 2, can't you, on BBC 2 or whatever, or BBC 4, and it'll show you clips of the 1980s, of all those songs, and you realise that those were the live songs when you were at Lambeter in the late 80s or whatever, or in my case it was anyway. Mm. But of course they're now seen as classics. Yeah. These are the classic songs. Maybe the same way as our parents listened to the Beatles or whatever and saw them as being the live events they used to go to. But of course, now they're classics, they're part of history.
Yeah, and it's funny how quickly a classic comes into place, because I'm thinking of, well, I mean, I saw Kirsty MacColl actually at Lambeter in, and of course, the fact that she then obviously passed away at a ridiculously young age. I think she was barely even 40 when she died. But in 1992, she was at the Arts Hall summer gig, and it was a big deal having her. And one of the first records I ever bought was There's a Guy Who Works Down the Chip Shop, Tracy's Elvis. So at that time, you know, that was only like 10 years on, 11 years on. But at that time, you know, that felt like a really seismic moment. You know, that was the closest to nostalgia, I guess, that my what 19 or whatever year old self could have entertained. But there was something in there, and I think this is the crucial thing, because I've always kept a diary, and having that sort of record of that period, when you then see the footage from the period and the photographs of that period, when you can really see, you know, everyone looks younger. But to have those, in some cases, vivid memories, but the juxtaposition of the vivid memory, the photograph that kind of proves that actually this was ancient history. And then these songs that have never aged, because, you know, they were as powerful back in, you know, the 80s as they were in the 90s, and then all these decades on. So I think on so many levels, you know, Lampeter was kind of the repository for all of these wonderful kind of unifying events, rituals even.
That's right, yeah. It was a wonderful sort of, it is, you know, interesting, isn't it, to look at all those pictures on Facebook that people post of the time when they were there, and you see the old knackered cars, as it were, that we used to drive, and you recognise suddenly, you know, the flashback to a way. But it often, for me, it doesn't just, you know, trigger, you know, memories of, you know, where you see things as they used to be, but also it triggers sort of the feelings I used to have, the feelings and the emotions, even the smells. I mean, if you remember the Lloyd Thomas Hall, of course, was built on top of the refectory where some of us occasionally used to frequent, yeah. If we were going to take a risk, obviously, with our diets. But the place, I mean, yeah, there was always that smell, wasn't there, of chips and beans and that sort of thing. And it's funny, when it's a composite of things. You remember the pictures, the sounds, the music, obviously, but it brings back aromas. It brings back feelings of how it felt to be 19 or 20 years old. Maybe for the first time having left school, as it were, and then being thrown into this mix of people. It's a wonderfully nostalgic thing. But as I said to you earlier, it means, for me, it's a very calming effect to look back on those times. And that's probably a good sign, because I know that some people can look back on Lampeter, maybe, and other places that were not feel so comfortable, maybe. I mean, that we have to remember that there are some people, because Lampeter was so original, there were some people for whom it didn't gel. But I can't say that's in my case. I mean, it was a place that I, you know, thoroughly enjoyed and feel very calm about and very grateful. The gratitude I feel sometimes about thinking about Lampeter, about what it did and how it formed me.
Yeah, and perhaps it's just worth saying something very briefly about the PhD and John Hick, because you're not the first person who I've interviewed who did a PhD, I think of Gerard Loughlin, who he didn't do his at Lampeter, but obviously there's a Lampeter connection, but studying John Hick.
That's right. I remember actually kind of when I was doing my PhD, because, of course, when you do a doctorate, it's worth checking out other doctorates, isn't it? And, of course, there was this PhD I remember Gerard Loughlin had done. And he'd done some amazing work. Oddly enough, because I know Gerard has since written about lots of different things. But he wrote a fantastic couple of chapters, actually, on this whole idea of resurrection bodies. Because John Hick, of course, has this whole thing he does on the replica theory. The idea that you and I will receive an exact replica of our bodies when we die. You know, that's one of the death and immortality things, obviously. And Gerard had done this fantastic couple of chapters that really helped me when I was forming my own PhD. So I always remember thinking, oh, my goodness, am I going to be able to write a PhD as good as this? So, you're right. I mean, and of course, that's Paul Baddon. Of course, Paul Baddon, his tutor was John Hick. So when he wrote his PhD, back in, I think it was 1976, and he was at Birmingham, of course, which is where John Hick was. So there's all these full circle things going on, isn't there? So yeah, but Paul was the best guy basically to have as a supervisor for John Hick, because he was close friends. And then years later, I met John Hick here at Birmingham before long, you know, of course I've been here for 20 years. And John Hick used to live 400 yards away from my office in Oak Tree Lane. So when I said to him, oh, you realise, John, that I've written a book about you, he says, oh, well, you must come and visit me sometime. So I used to go around and visit him, and he would serve you a rather strong sherry and I think some cheese that had been in the fridge a bit too long, if you know what I mean. But I often thought I was able to sit there and talk to John Hick about his work and talk about Lampeter and talk about Paul Baddon with him, who he remembered very fondly, by the way. But John Hick, even though back then he was about 85, and there was me, this upstart academic who thought he knew a bit, you know what I mean? But he was always very sharp. He was able to run rings around me when I tried to outmaneuver him, because I knew John Hick's work so well. I thought, right, ha-ha, I've got you now on this particular problem. But he was very quick, really impressive thinker. but also extremely generous. So when you said silly things, or when you came up with a viewpoint that John Hick didn't agree with, he was very polite, even though people were sometimes very impolite in return. John was very, very polite. But I was able to say to him, you know, I did my PhD on you with Paul Badham, and then I ended up getting a job here at the University of Birmingham, where he'd been the H.G. Wood Professor of Theology. And then, of course, I ended up meeting him because, of course, he'd retired to basically up the road, Oak Tree Lane.
And have you not met him in Lampeter?
Well, you see, I was... This is it, I'm afraid, you see. I mean, he came to visit once and he was doing it to give a lecture. And Paul Badham says, oh, David, you know how Paul Badham was, very enthusiastic. Oh, you must come and see John. So I kind of came to see him. But the thing is, believe it or not, there was a rehearsal for the Blend Band because we had a gig the next day after he was giving a lecture. Yeah. So I remember I was having this rehearsal in this farmyard, this barn somewhere near Tregaron or something. And I said to the rest of the guys, look, I've got to get back. There's John Hicks turning up to give this lecture. And it'll look really bad if me doing a PhD on it just neglects to go to this lecture. So I remember just driving, you know, finishing the rehearsal, getting in the car, belting it to the Lampeter to get back to the lecture theatre, and kind of stumbling in about 10 minutes after the beginning of the lecture. And then Paul just said, oh, David, this is John. So I was introduced, and because I was just shy, and I was only about 23, 22, I can't remember how old I was. But I remember just mumbling something incoherent, you know, and just didn't have anything to say. So he got to see the real me, I suppose, in terms of what I was intellectually able to convey much, much later on. I'm sure his memory of me was extremely fleeting at Lampeter, this rather furtive-looking guy who didn't know quite where he was.
It does happen, doesn't it? When they always say, you know, be careful about meeting your heroes, in the sense that...
You always go in there preparing a speech where you hope that you'll say something really profound that they'll be impressed with and think, my goodness me, I've got to get to know this guy. Mm. But all that happens, you end up just fumbling around for the words.
Which is exactly what happened with me, because I've never met Martin Scorsese, but my PhD was largely on him. I guess Scorsese was to my PhD, in your case, Czech was central to yours, whereas Scorsese was played a big part in it, but perhaps not exclusively so. But I met his editor, his Oscar-winning editor, Thelma Schoonmaker, in Canterbury. There's a big Canterbury connection. And it was a public event, and she was talking about her experience of working with Scorsese. But it wasn't a specialist audience. It was more about the great and the good in Canterbury. And then what happened is I came up with what I thought I have to ask a really posh question, as it were, for such a big event. And, you know, it was Thelma Schoonmaker at the end of the day. And I asked a question, and I tried to bring in all sorts of clever stuff. Not in a way of deliberately being pretentious, but more I thought, you know, this is my one and only opportunity to speak to somebody who's, been at the forefront of Scorsese's work since Raging Bull, and then she said something like, "Oh, that's a bit too clever a question. I can't really answer it." And I was, you know, shocked that, you know, I'd asked this question and completely misread the room. And I spoke to her afterwards, and then it suddenly struck me that when I was saying I did my PhD on Scorsese, she might have thought, you know, the look on her face wasn't sort of, "Oh, tell me more about it. That's really interesting." It was like, "Oh, you know, I need to get away." And I suddenly thought that it was probably on some level the sort of the stalker thing, where somebody says, "Hey, I'm your greatest fan," and they're like, yeah, rather than say, "Tell me about it," they're like, "I really have to go."
You remind them about a childhood story that you'd read somewhere about them, and they didn't even remember themselves. Yeah. But yeah, I mean, I remember kind of that time when I saw Hick. I think I remember I said to him, "I'm really impressed with your eschatological verification theory, which I think has a number of problems." Mm. And that was it. The meeting was over. "Oh, very interesting. Anyway, nice to meet you." Sort of. You know, awfully embarrassing. You know, you don't know whether to make small talk or try to look impressive, but you end up looking like an idiot, basically. So, yeah, that was my first meeting with John Hicks. It's not something I want to kind of remember very much. Now I have just remembered it, obviously. Yeah. But yeah, the real meeting, I think, was between me and him then years later, when I was, which is probably better because I was more of a fully formed individual. And so I was able to have a really good conversation with him, and I did, and he was fantastically helpful, really generous, even if you would, and you felt very comfortable exploring ideas with John Hick, because he had this wonderful ability of not making you feel like an idiot. and really take, and he really used to ponder very deeply about what you were saying to him. So even though, to be honest with you, as I progress and mature myself as a theologian, I find I don't agree with a lot of John Hick's thinking now. Years later, I think that, you know, some of the things that he said and thought about, I can't really go along with very much of it. Still, the fact remains is that his whole brilliance, I think, as a thinker has influenced me ever since. And I now, because he was amazing, Hick, I think, in my view, and I would say that I know because I did a PhD on it, but he covered just about every area in the philosophy of religion. So some guys, they just focus on one particular area. They become an expert at, say, you know, the concept of the soul or life after death or death or problem of evil and suffering or something. But he, of course, he wrote about all these things. And every single book that he produced has become a kind of a milestone in the debates. So it was so actually studying people like Hick is a comprehensive education. And it was the education I got studying Hick that I didn't really get when I did my undergraduate because I was too busy having fun. So Hick was a great education in the end.
Yeah, and I found as well, because, I mean, in a way, actually, they had very different personalities, John Hick and Paul Badham, because oh, yeah. I think Paul, it was funny because what we were doing, it was probably that very lecture that you're referring to, that it was towards the end of 92, and we were doing the modern theology course with Paul, and the John Hick lecture was actually then done by John Hick. So it was like, next week we're doing John Hick, but actually, John Hick will be delivering it. And of course, it was a public event and everybody attended. And what was really, I think, incredible about John Hick is, and you're right, because even like, you know, I have school children coming to Kent sometimes, and they say they're looking at him on their syllabus, but you're right, because he brought parapsychology into the domain. That's H.H. Price had done it a generation earlier, but in a way it made it respectable and acceptable to talk about those very things that always perhaps would seem to be a bit more on the margins.
I once asked him, see, one of my moldy cheese sherry moments that I had in Oak Tree Lane, he said the book that he was most worried about publishing when before it came out was Death and Eternal Life, and that's the book where, of course, he develops a lot of his work on parapsychology. Yeah. And he said, when he said, he finished the book, which is about 500 pages long. It's a very lengthy work. Mm-hmm. And he said he was really worried because he thought, actually, sometimes when you finish writing something, as you know, you step back from it. And then a month later, you look at what you've written again and you think, my God, is that what I thought? But he thought that about the whole book. Yeah. And in the end, of course, it became a classic. You know, it's a classic book anyway now. But he was really worried that the parapsychology bit would come across as a bit cuckoo. You know what I mean? That he'd taken seriously something which shouldn't be really taken seriously. Then anyway, at least. But no, you're right. He was the first guy to really kind of run with it. And of course, then Paul Badham runs with that a great deal in his book, Immortality and Extinction, I think it's called, where he does a whole load of stuff on near-death experiences, which are extremely interesting. And students, as you say, are gripped by those stories about people rising above their bodies, going down the hospital corridors and all this sort of stuff, you know.
Yeah, because when it all started, so I think it was 76, wasn't it, that Death and Eternal Life came out. And at that point, you're right, it would have been seen to be very sort of against the trend in academia. And yet, obviously, Paul Badham studied under John Hick. And then certainly by the time then that I went to university, this was actually now reputable because of the publications that Paul had done, and the fact that he taught it with such fervency that it's easy to forget that maybe 15 years before I studied all of this at university, it really wasn't the sort of, like, I suppose, to an extent, but for different reasons, the stuff I do on film. You know, when I did my theology degree at Lampeter, we never looked at film. You know, then I did my PhD on that, and it was wonderful to have Paul Badham on board as one of the examiners, because I was drawing on a lot of John Hick, and indeed Paul Badham for that matter, but I was putting a film slant onto it, which was new. That was like the next generation sort of approach. And that, so I always, and I'm still in touch with Paul, but, you know, I always sort of make it clear that in so many ways, you know, he was the progenitor, if you like, of the work that I do. And it's the blend between those very different disciplines.
And there weren't many around, if you think about it. I mean, Paul is one of the pioneers, really, of what's called thanatology, isn't it? And, you know, I mean, so he's one of the, and he was a full professor who was looking at these particular aspects and taking them on board. And he kind of brought them as what you might call evidential aspects of effectively his dualistic viewpoint. So Badham had a, he was a defender of dualism. So he kind of, you read his book called Christian Beliefs About Life After Death. He was defending the idea of the immaterial soul. He was one of the big defenders of that. And of course, then near-death experiences then was a kind of an empirical evidential aspect of how is it possible for the soul to leave the body and all that sort of stuff. So I think it was that Paul, you know, brought it into his bigger discussion that he was doing.
Yeah, and here we are now, yeah, with my students all these years on, and it's the most exciting part, without a doubt. You know, that's what they're all writing about, and the whole, you know, Susan Blackmore versus Paul Badham. It's like the Dawkins of the last generation.
Absolutely right, and of course, I mean, there are many films that are now being made about the whole possibility of survival and all this sort of stuff, which take near death experiences very seriously, and. Yeah, it's a very exciting area, isn't it? And it's the thing that I suppose that makes theology sometimes, when you're doing it with students, seem to be far more immediate. Yeah. If you can throw in a discussion about near-death experiences, then of course it really raises the question beyond the mere textbook kind of studies of what theology and religion's all about.
Yeah, you're right, because so many of the students will then talk about their auntie, or maybe in some cases somebody, you know, very close to them who's had certainly an out of body, if not a near death experience, and it raises, you know, questions about everyone's own, you know, we live in a world of, you know, when, you know, the next essay mark and the degree result and maybe the next career, but actually dealing with some of those ultimate questions, I think, is a bit much for some people, but also others sort of say, you know, we need, you know, in no other place, in no other module or degree program would we be tackling these ultimate questions. And I think that it's it has a lot of currency. Obviously we're just starting to wrap up, but I was just sort of thinking, David, whether, you know, looking back on this, you know, have you fulfilled the dreams that you had when you were young? Could you ever have imagined, you know, your 5 or indeed your 15 year old self imagining that you'd be working in academia?
Well, that's a really excellent question, and that's you know, I remember when I was about, this is, you'll laugh at this maybe, when I was about 14 or 15, we had a teacher at school, this was back in High Wycombe, and he said, he was a geography lesson or something like that, I can't remember what it was, but he was also in charge of careers. And he said, well, write down on your notebooks, as it were, I want you to write down what you would like to be. And believe it or not, and I'm amazed at this, because I don't know why I did it, but I wrote down Professor David Cheetham. You know, and then I got a bit stupid. I wrote lots of letters after my name because I just thought, why not? Other people were doing other things like, you know, Sir Watson. but I always remember, you see, I my teacher, he kind of went around the tables and kind of looked over our shoulders at what we'd written down on our workbooks. And he saw that I'd written Professor. And he said, oh, that's a bit ambitious, isn't it, Cheetham? So in some ways, I'm rather pleased that, you know, well, 40 years later, I suppose, I'm sitting here in a university as a professor. And so in a way, I kind of, was it my ambition? I suppose, had you asked me back then, I wanted to be a composer. Mm. I was a musician. Maybe a bit later on, I would have said I wanted to be a priest. I am a priest in the Church of England as well. So yeah, I have fulfilled my dreams. But it's funny, isn't it, when you arrive, that what you wrote down as being something you'd like to do, you're now sitting here and you realise, well, this is the dream, and I've got to try and realise, you know, all the opportunities that it gives me at the same time. But I'm really pleased in some ways that it's not just, you know, the dream I had before Lampeter, but as I said to you, all the formative things that Lampeter opened up. So I still play in bands, for example. I still play in a little jazz band with a few friends. And I would never have done that had I never gone to Lampeter. So there's still a couple of legacies, obviously, that keep on staying with me as a result of Lampeter. But yeah, I would say I am living the dream that I wrote down on my little notebook when I was 14, and my teacher thought it was a bit too ambitious.
And did you stay in touch with that teacher at all?
I think he was at a certain age, so I don't think he's still alive, but I would have been, yes, it would have been the ultimate triumphal moment to have marched back to John Hamden and say, well, there you go, you were wrong.
Well, when they make the film of your life, well, when you have the David Cheetham story, you know, we've had the Glenn Miller story, and, you know, we've had, you know, musicals of ABBA, and I think there's a new film coming out with the music of Blondie. So when they do you with the Blend band as the musical accompaniment, then there will be that moment when you go to that teacher and you say, in heaven, maybe John Hick will be there as well. And, and you'll be able to say, look what I've done.
Well, the irony is that one of the most famous songs I think the Blend band ever done was called Vegetables of Satan. I don't know whether that should be my soundtrack.
I suppose I've got to ask, but I've got one more question in just a minute. But did Paul Badham know about all the musical stuff that you were doing? Was he aware of that hinterland?
I don't know. That's brilliant. I don't know what to say about that. Yeah. I mean, I know he probably saw me occasionally come to supervisions looking a bit bleary-eyed and distracted. And as you know, I was rather a late entrant when it came to the John Hick lecture because I'd just run away from a Blend band rehearsal or something like that. But I don't think he was very... I think, oddly enough, that's a very good question. I wonder how much our lecturers were actually aware of what we did. Yeah. Because I would like to believe, maybe naively, that I managed to keep the two worlds separate. That there was me, David Cheetham, the supervisee who was writing his doctorate. And then there was the rather wild Dave Chisholm. So, I, of course, had another name when I was at Lambertown. My Justin Rees kind of branded me Dave Chisholm because he could never remember my surname, so he called me Chisholm. And that became my kind of stage name. So I always wondered whether I was able to successfully keep the two worlds discreet. But I bet our lecturers knew more than they let on.
I'm obviously used to seeing my students in supermarkets, and I guess they may have the same reaction to seeing me there that I may have done if I'd ever seen Paul Badham there. But it is curious because in those days it seemed really strange to think that this, you know, professor who'd be talking about near-death experiences, you know, would be doing something as banal as going shopping in the co-op. For some reason that seemed odd in a way that it doesn't feel odd to me now that I'm, you know, pretty much the same age that Paul Badham would have been when he taught me all those years ago, you know. And of course I go to the cinema and I boast about it, you know, I don't think, you know, 30 years ago I can't imagine Paul Badham in the same way having that sort of form of dissemination.
Because we I mean, I wonder if our students feel the same about, I know you say you obviously put on Facebook all the films that you watch, but, you know, I wonder whether what our students think we are, our interests look like beyond the lecture room. And similarly with Paul Badham and people like that, I mean, I have no idea what his interests are. I have to be honest. I don't know whether you know, but I don't know what other interests he had other than the theology stuff that I regularly encountered. For all I know, he might have been great at gardening. Maybe he built kind of model railways or something. For all I know, I've got no idea what his wider interests would be.
Well, I did invite him once to do an interview with me, and he didn't say no, but we'll see.
Well, maybe make sure the interview is all about his what he likes doing, and try to steer him away from the academia.
and my very last question, David, are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person? Very apt question to ask, I guess, considering we've just been talking about eschatological verification.
I think, yeah, well, that's a great question, isn't it? Well, you see, the point is that people look forward a lot if they don't want to look back. I like looking back, and I think that's a testament to, you know, the nostalgia, which I think is genuine. I genuinely have a good nostalgia about some of the things I've done up till now. And Lampeter, you know, is looms large, as it were, in that memory. But I think you have to use it to look forward. You can't. I know that I like going back to Lambertown, and I go back, you know, fairly regularly. You know, maybe once a year, potentially, maybe not as frequently as that. And it's good to do that. But I think you have to use that to look forward. You have to enjoy the forward things that are to come. So I think healthily, you know, it's good to look back if it's nice to look back, which it is. But you have to use it to look forward.
Yeah, well, it's been a pleasure to look back and look forward over the last hour. David, it's been brilliant to have you as my guest this week.
Yeah, it's been a great pleasure. Thanks.